One of the great promises of the World Wide Web was that it was going to shatter the barrier between regular citizens and the media. Online, everyone could be both content creator and consumer, and the industrial age notion of big media would collapse under the weight of millions of blogs, videos, and podcasts. This hasn't quite happened, though, and as recent events at Facebook have shown, even those platforms that promise to liberate us from the one-way communication of traditional media are vulnerable to manipulation. At the same time, in a significant way, Twitter in particular has made it much easier for journalists in so-called traditional media to embed the voices of ordinary people into their stories. Heidi Torek believes that's a big problem.
They're using tweets to create reaction stories and also to embed tweets as a kind of person on the street. So instead of doing what media organizations used to do, which is go out on the street and actually ask people on the street, many journalists are using Twitter instead.
Heidi teaches media and the history of communications at the University of British Columbia. She recently wrote a paper called Responsible Reporting in an Age of Irresponsible Information.
And what we find is that many of those tweets are not actually created by ordinary people at all. They're being created by troll factories.
And just how serious a problem is this?
So one recent study actually found in a U.S. context that 32 out of 33 major news outlets had embedded tweets that were created by the St. Petersburg-based troll factory, the Internet Research Agency.
Which has links to Putin, I think, right?
Yes, so it's being, we believe, funded by somebody who's a very close friend of Vladimir Putin.
Yikes. So is this just a case of journalists being lazy, or is there something else going on here?
I think it's a combination of things. It's an eagerness to represent a broad array of views, which is something that is good and useful to bring in social media, but it's a lack of understanding of the new verification processes that I think we need on Twitter. So some of it I trace to just being like Vox Pop. So thinking, okay, Twitter is just a quicker way of, instead of going out to a shopping mall and asking someone their opinion, I'll just pull some tweets. Mm-hmm. But actually, there are some strong differences, namely that you can fake who you are on Twitter. And so what I suggest is that really what journalists need to do is put in that extra 5-10 minutes of effort just to check that somebody really is who they say they are. So they can do really simple things like check using tools like Botometer to see if somebody is a bot. They could try and write to them over a direct message, but most importantly, they should try and speak to someone over the phone, because some of the people whose tweets were featured actually did reply to direct messages, and they seemed real and American. But in fact, one of them, Jenna Abrams, turned out to be a wholly fabricated persona coming out of the Internet Research Agency, and she refused to speak on the phone, which would have been a big red flag.
Mm-hmm. With so much scrutiny being directed at Facebook these days, how do you think Twitter has escaped, focus in this context?
I think it probably depends on what media we're reading. So there was a lot of critique, I think, of both Facebook and Twitter. It's just that the Cambridge Analytica aggregate IQ scandal has put a lot of attention on Facebook. But actually, both platforms suffer from problems. They're just different problems. So Facebook has an incentive to clean up all of the bots because they want to create what they call community and have real human interactions. And that can be manipulated in lots of ways. Twitter, on the other hand, has the incentive to appear to have as many users as possible. So it's not in their incentive to get rid of the bots or automation. So there's certainly been some research which has started to talk about this, but maybe one final reason why Twitter hasn't been as widely reported on is it's not used by as many people. Most people who encounter Twitter, they encounter it actually through these embedded tweets and journalists amplifying Twitter. Journalists are absolutely addicted to Twitter. They love it. And that's one of the reasons why Donald Trump uses it, is because he gets a lot of journalistic coverage out of it. And so journalists need to be very careful about the ways that they're actually the ones propagating these embedded tweets. That's how 90% of the population is seeing this sort of stuff.
Although, I mean, this is supposed to be the promise of social media, right? That it would break down this kind of one-way flow of communication in the mass media and open things up. So isn't there something valuable in trying to include more perspectives?
Oh, definitely. I think the point is to include perspectives that journalists are representing as the people they say they are. So the problem with, for example, Jenna Abrams is she was getting her tweets embedded in journalistic stories as if she was a Trump-supporting all-American woman. Mm-hmm. But it turned out she's a troll created by a Russian troll factory. So my plea is not to get rid of the ordinary people. I think that's deeply important, but we should make sure that they're ordinary and that they're people.
So you find that this kind of problem about, you know, who's actually being represented there with a so-called vox populi of finding the popular voice isn't a problem that just arose with social media. So how long has this been an issue in the media?
So vox pop has existed in various ways since probably the late 19th century. It's always been a goal of newspapers to have readers involved in various kinds of ways, but it becomes particularly popular and widespread after World War II with the rise of radio and television. So lots of TV evening news broadcasts would feature somebody, a presenter, going onto the street and asking people their opinion on a certain issue. And there were lots of reasons why this made sense. It would give color to a local story, it could give life to a scientific study, or it was one way of finding a new angle on some sort of annual event like St. Patrick's Day or in the US Independence Day, etc. So this has long been used as a journalistic tool. And it had all sorts of great things to it, but it also had some issues, namely that it was just a random selection mm-hmm. of people that you happened to find who gave you good quotations.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the other difference with, you know, using Twitter in stories is that now what happens is that sometimes the tweets become the story. It's not so much that you're telling the story, it's that, you know, the series of reactions and counter reactions that unfolded on Twitter become the story in its entirety.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes the story isn't even the tweet, but the number of replies or retweets or likes on the tweet. And that, too, is very problematic because that can be gamed in all sorts of different ways through other bots. So what we see is the number of retweets that we might take as an indication of popularity is actually popularity engineered by technology in a whole bunch of different ways. And that's very different than vox pop in TV, where everyone understood, okay, this is one person's opinion on the street. With Twitter, you may think that an opinion is much more popular than it actually is because it seems to have 500,000 likes.
Are you suggesting that those likes might be themselves from bots?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we don't necessarily know. And there are estimates that vary greatly, but it could be that between 10 and 20% of those likes are bots. Or if it's something that seems useful to promote, it could be that anywhere up to 50% of those likes are bots. We simply don't know.
So what's the solution to this? Is there a way to incorporate the voice of the quote-unquote average person, or does that person not even exist?
I think there are definitely still ways to do it. One of my main suggestions is that news organizations need to create better verification guidelines. Things like trying to contact people on the phone to make sure that they are who they say they are. It's time-consuming, but you might rather do that as a journalist than find out later that you've been tricked by a troll. That's one suggestion. The other is to include tweets without necessarily keeping the part that tells you the number of likes or retweets or replies, because that can be misleading.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me in your article you refer to sort of best practices as being not confusing this is a sample of opinions that we found with saying this is in some way like a poll. This is what most people think.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, this dovetails very much with old classic BBC news guidelines on vox pop. And the BBC says very clearly, you have to know that vox pop is a tool of illustration, not a tool of research. And I'd add to that, it's not a tool of research or representation.
Heidi, thanks so much for your thoughts on this.
Thanks for having me, Nora.
Heidi Torek is an assistant professor of history at UBC and a non-resident fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States.